At this time, we will have a short pause for music, and our organist this evening performing is Dr. H. Max Smith. Our next speaker is Dr. Carlisle Marney, who will address us on the topic, Writers Together in the Church. Dr. Marney is formerly pastor of the Myers Park Baptist Church in Charlotte, and is presently the director of the Interpreter's House in Lake Junaluska, North Carolina. Dr. Marney is, I think, a great man and a great preacher and a great friend to me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I should like to begin by expressing my regard for the opportunity to be on the program with this man. I felt what he brought us was brilliantly conceived and executed. I wish he had taken another 20 minutes of the time, that I might have cut mine shorter, because I think what we have to have in the way of help has to come from him more than it has to come from folk like me. I'm grateful that I know him. He is one of 300 or 400 friends I have in this state who are doing some terribly dangerous and terribly important work. I salute what he offered us as a work of brilliance and of grace, because there were lots of things he might have said that he forbore from saying. There's an obligation implicit in the invitation of your committee. I am required to speak of a gospel universal as perceived from my own time and place. This means that I am obligated to speak of a matter that involves you in the language I have learned and used in my 20 years of living through the long hot summer of our current moment of truth. That is to say, you have a right to hear Fuller or me say what we have said at home. Indeed, I said this at home, and indeed I've said this in Harlem, but you would expect perhaps to hear a Southern gospel, south of God. If it should turn out that you have heard the same bell in some other crossroads, it could mean we've shared a genuine universal beyond our time and place. Because there's no way to speak of church now that does not involve the topic, church and race. There is no question as in my mind as to which races must occupy our thoughts. But which church is it? Is it the church of the Lord Christ? The church qua church? The church of all climes and times? That church has no race problem. It never had a race problem. It never will. This church, the church of the Lord Christ, never heard of race except as a mischievous and retardative and damnable term. This church of Jesus Christ has never had that problem. It began beyond that problem in the service of one human race. I wish I could talk of that church. But I think you expect me to talk of the church of Jesus Christ as it has been perverted in the culture. This we all can do, but to speak of both would require two speeches. If we were, for a moment, to think of the great church, I should have to put it at its own center. Experientially, not technically, but experientially, the own center is the grand confession at Caesarea Philippi. Whom do men say that I am? The Lord questions and gets his answer. Then comes the unnerving, shatteringly personal antithesis. But whom do you say that I am? When Simon Peter says, as reported in Matthew, Thou Christ, he's brought a devastating synthesis, which is the base for all the life of the confessing church thereafter. Whether it happened or not is quite another matter. It's still the basis of the confessing church, to whom our Lord says, Congratulations, Peter. The shape of your confession has determined the scope of your church. It always does. On this rock, he says, I will be building the church of me. That is to say, a confession of the Lordship puts a man in church. And the hell of it is that the nature and size of the Lordship determines what church you're in and its bounds. Where you've got a proper Lordship, the resulting church has Lordship over even death, for not even the gates of hell can withstand the proper Lordship. But the tragedy is that the character of the church is in the character of its Lord. Most of you who serve churches will serve a church that is less than church because it has a Lord who is less than Lord. This is the church that has no race problem. This church of the Lord Christ knows only the saga of redemption. It knows itself as the womb within which persons happen. It knows itself as the historical locus of our inmanning. It's the means of the extension of a kingdom. It's the driver of heartlessness from the earth. It's the releaser of prisoners and the opening of the eyes of the blind and the deliverer to them that are bound. Is this the church we are to speak of here in Wake Forest? If so, the races are already in, and we have one song to sing, the song of Moses and the Lamb, "Worthy art thou, O Lord." But is this our church? Well, whom do you say that he is? Thou Christ? If he is Lord, really, why is he so lenient? Why do some of us have so much left over when others must come on Saturday to borrow bread? If he is Lord, how can it cost some so little to get his benefits? If he is a Lord we can trust, why are we so concerned with our status and stores? If he is Lord, why is grace so cheap, so scattered, and so spotted in its Baptist variety, and so temporary? If he is Lord, why are we so bumbling and inept at changing things when there's a Baptist majority over every square acre between here, Durham, and Raleigh? I passed the word Baptist 5 times between Durham and here this afternoon, and the only other religious term I saw was a YWCA camp. If we are speaking of that great church, why is it so local? The church of which he is Lord, against which not even death can prevail. If we're talking about this, why is it in the 62 years since Governor Aycock in Raleigh, in his inaugural address, began to push it down the throat of North Carolina that we would die if we did not give our one-third citizens a fair chance? 62 years. Why has so little been done? If it's his church you're training to serve, and that is so dominant in our so-called Bible Belt, why is this state where it is in educational spending, in functional illiteracy, in educational failures, and why do we have so many houses unfit for human animals to live in? If he is Lord, where are his lands? If he is Lord, where are his folk? Where are his barns and his stores and his factories? His reserves, his troops. If he is Lord, where is his legislature? Where are his change forces? Where are his schools? Where are his banks? If he is Lord, and we speak at all from within his church, why are our bins so full and his so empty? And why does he have so little need for our work? Over which of these high-rise, teeming areas of despair does the saga of redemption get reduced by our involvement in the toils of some great diverting evil? But I approach presumptuousness. our Bible Belt, so-called, doesn't reach as far as Brooklyn or the Bronx or Harlem. While I could say this at Riverside, I'm not sure I'd have a right to say it anywhere else, because the problem there is Puerto Ricans. Yet, in an aside, there remains for me a muttered question. It rises in the same way for me on the backside of any American city. Is this his church whose environs we have walked? This littered yard, this festering swamp, these smothered angels, is he Lord of this? In my time and place for 30 years, he was a quarter-time Lord. That ain't much church, quarter-time church. Some of you know this the hard way, but it ain't much Lord either. The character of the church is prima facie evidence of the quality of his lordship. When the church is a fifth-rate power, when the church is a part-time do-gooder, when the church is a mild cathartic castoria or a deadly bore, or a glob of Confederate ideals clinging to the lusty limbs of a cancerous secular growth, where the church is spiritless, defeated, sidetracked, conformist, stupid, and blind, it's like its concept of its Lord. It always is. The church is always like its Lord. If church is less than church, it is because its Lord is less than Lord. Luther's great dictum, by which he controls 70 German princes, cuius regio, eius religio, whose the region, his the religion, applies even here. We're talking of a lesser church, the church that belongs to its territory. The church only here and there, then, can sing the broad and stirring saga of redemption. The song we hear mostly is Jezebel's song, in which the saga of redemption is reduced by our involvement in the toils of this present evil. So, let us talk of church, that is, whatever of church it is, within the domain of that woman Jezebel, the church you'll be serving. And there'll be one there, you can count on it. This church is in trouble everywhere. Everywhere. I do not know a church that's not in trouble. In Gunnar Myrdal's Challenge to Affluence, he says, all of the rich countries are islands in an ocean of underdeveloped countries where people live in a poverty so abject and miserable that we can hardly grasp it as a fact. A substratum of hopeless and miserable people detached from the world at large. Let me transpose that sentence for use in this sanctuary. All the richer churches are surrounded by swamps, where people live in a poverty so abject and miserable that we can hardly grasp it as a fact. A substratum of hopeless and miserable neighbors detached from the city at large. These are the disfranchised. They do not vote, read, hear, go, buy, or give. They live as drugged. They suffer four times the crime, four times the unemployment, 50 times the communicable diseases, four times the physically unfit. They live in a logarithmic relationship with disease, degeneracy, and death. Then Christ comes to town for Christmas in time to read in a lolly newspaper that all one little girl wants for Christmas is to get rid of the rats under her house owned by some good church deacon. Somewhere this picture must begin fundamentally to change. There are no new crimes. There are no new perversions. They all have Latin names 1,500 years old, or Greek or Egyptian names. Ezekiel's verbal adjectives are alive in any city and in every American city. The richness of our poverty is exceeded only by the real poverty of all our riches. But in all the world, is there any poverty like that poverty that surrounds our cathedral churches in the cities? This poverty has no character. It's got no gut. It's got no stamina. It's got no character. And the sensitive church that sees and smells it is in trouble everywhere. For mostly we fear change. But it's stupid. Why are we so afraid these changing masses will come to our church? They will not wish to come. They will not come until a great repenting precedes them. All my life, my prophets, and some of them are here in this room still, and graced this room long ago. For two generations, our prophets have been confessing for us that we have been greater rebels against the law to love than the publican and the harlot, because we were sent to talk of a kingdom of love for all. But mostly we have gone on witnessing, as F.D. Morris once said, to separation, to exclusion, and to ourselves. Hence, I know no church that's threatened by any invasion from any changing mass. They will not come. What makes us think they wish to come? Their sharp minds and hungry spirits are equipped with critical powers for asking cutting questions. 400 blacks last year in our retreat center, and they asked me, these sharp young intellectuals with guitars and folk songs and restless feet, they asked me, and do not know they are almost quoting F.D. Morris 140 years ago, but they asked me, how is it that you have no real power to change men where they really hurt? They ask me, quote, how do you expect to convince us of God's love while you are so busy denying it? They say, why do you talk in affected language to sleepy congregations of a grace willing to forgive if only men would repent, but you have no straight word about where, how, and for what one must repent? They say, your fathers had a mighty charm in their hands when they first talked to us of a father, but you knew they did not think he was father enough that we could afford to be brothers. They say, in all your creeds and your prayers and your hymns, you said God had come to help us, and we believed it better than you meant us to believe it, but why are you so powerless and unhappy when you believe it? We take groups of preachers in groups of 30. They throw up for 2 weeks. This is why we have the third week. Or they say to me, why do you at your best proclaim your good news mostly to the well-upholstered who want a not too troublesome religion, or in the ears of a few tasters who want chiefly some new thing? Why can you not speak to us who have hungered and thirsted? Or they say, quote, why would we come to you when you cannot stir even your own hearts, much less ours? What would we want with your colorless, spineless, heartless religion without rhythm? If there is a law to love, we have been fighting against it. The other racial intellectual, like the respected man I have just heard and you, does not seek my church in any significant numbers. But this does not mean he stays with his own church. Is the day of the great black church over? I do not know. but except for its grand place here, and I walked all the way around one with Elizabeth last week in a little town in Alabama where some big things started once on the main square. Pretty sorry, little old building, but it was a big enough place for King's March to start. I do not know, except for the black church's grand place here and there as a rallying point for marches, I'm afraid its day is over. I hear the same keen young minds asking their Negro holy men, why do you refuse to address us as persons? Can you tell me of my heritage and my parentage from the 16th century? Can you tell me of my sources and myself? Can you tell me what I am and who I am and who is really for me and who is constantly against me? In droves, they say, we have not found that you can. They're saying to their pastors, you have a religion for us, but you manipulate us. You do not respect us. You do not know that the distance from where we started to where we now are entitles us to a special hearing. You cannot hear us. You are mostly professionals. We cannot afford you, Pastor. You are a luxury, and we are fighting for necessities. Consequently, the gospel of manhood and the battle for maturity is preached and fought by other spokesmen on a different platform than church, except here and there. It is a religiously historical dictum that any race given desire and time will come up in the world. You can count on it. You can just bet on it. But the old warfare of a race ascendant is being waged around and again on different ground. And once more here, the Negro church is a pawn, not a knight or a bishop. We are in terrible trouble, for the new war is a set of class wars fought on a broader scale than in church. And we face within the Negro communities largely a warfare that has emptied the church of meaning before and in other societies, and it breeds a strange anomaly. Only middle-class virtues can breed character into our pools of poverty, but this very set of virtues breeds a neglect of the helpless in a pool of neglect and ruin. In a dozen significant ways, in a thousand significant places, the race war is won. We are in the class wars now, and they sometimes are more vicious. I rejoice, I guess, in the new subdivisions, except for their fringes. But I shrink from the carnage I have smelled in every emerging Negro aristocracy. Sometimes among few blacks, where my face is no barrier, and where I am known, I can say to my compeers among Negroes, why are you so hard on each other? Why are you so merciless and pitiless, so jealous and envious? Why must you be just like white folks in these things? Has your 400-year captivity in our Babylon taught you nothing you could use to save us? Why must you so avidly help us demonstrate the aching truth in James Baldwin's claim that Protestantism will always be a never-ending winter? I know that some white men can be trusted. And I know that some Negro men can be trusted. But why do so few of us trust each other? and must, working intimately with a dozen, mean always I have to walk on eggshells of crackling personal antipathies that are shot through the whole society. What is this almost inevitable personal rejection I feel among you? Must the making of an aristocracy breed always an underclass? So, I have no faith whatever that any emergence of any social structure will save us. I rejoice in every church at God's left hand that I know about, in the dedicated caseworkers, the government agents, the enlightened employers, the family counselors, the entrepreneurs of an economic uplift. But I know that any real healing must come from a more valid integration, the discovery of the church of a proper Lord. With respect to the emergence of this church, I am incurably idealist. I keep thinking it'll happen. I keep thinking folks will get saved. I always look for Messiah to come down the middle aisle while I was preaching, but it was always some damn Klansman or another. But I've always looked for Messiah. I keep thinking preaching can help. I keep thinking we will learn how to make the church a different thing. Perhaps my trouble is that I want it out of this world. But at minimum, I cannot be cured from expecting it to be different. St. Paul knew this, that the church ought to be like nothing else in the world. Even the Gothic cathedral builders knew this, as their vaulting arches and buttresses testify. The church is like nothing else in the world when it's church. But we know now that the church must remain in this world, but if she is ever church, she will be different and would make a difference. That difference which church qua church makes is a qualitative distinction. It arises from her way of life, her politiste, her politics. It appears in her worship work, her liturgia. It lives in her service, her diaconia. It communicates itself throughout her fellowship, her koinonia, in the life of open dialogue, and that would be a year of preaching. But again, that qualitative difference will be a qualitative penetration. This requires the open life of dialogue to be lived in a priest at every elbow, a priesting laity who have been found by the demand that we do in persons and families and societies. There's a working and an obeying we are to do. And this too would require a year for its explication. But is it all a deluded hope? We do not have to answer that. For this church of a proper Lord, hope, deluded or not, is all we've got for hope. Its explication would begin in obedience, horrible word. So susceptible to the cancer of uncontrolled activism, and yet the base is the ethic of act. The hope rests in a doing we will do, not a preaching we will preach. For 20 years, I mostly preached before I discovered that most of our preaching is to screen what we will not do. And then one day I stumbled on that priceless confession of Rasputin, if I can, I do. If I cannot, I preach about it. What a setting in which to bed Paul Lehmann's indicative ethic. But it is not miscast. For with Rasputin as a prod, I found that one single act on my part would say more in 3 months than 20 years of sporadic talking had done. There's a saying to be said, yeah, but there's a doing you must do with which you are never finished, but it in turn must rise from a someone you are a being you are becoming, and this is the work of a lifetime and a moment. I cannot end this never-ending winter of ours with such a sermon. It takes my life of doing, being. But I can bring this witness to a focus for tonight by proposing a being doing to any who wishes to confirm his hopes that the church may truly happen. If you wish to know for certain that it can be a different and a redemptive thing out of our character as Christians, there is a doing to be done. Across whatever racial lines may bother you, let me share my own checklist for doing and obeying. Have you caused anyone to be hired across race lines? You have resources. Are you personally connected with the education of any person outside your own family? Are you personally involved with any family in its attempts to overcome some cultural so-called deficit? Are you serving as a resource for any man of different race who is looking for his and your selfhood? Do you believe in change? Does every person you meet in the world look different to you? Can you even hate or dislike a person without racial factors entering the picture? Is there anyone across racial lines to whom you can really talk? Have you had the aesthetic experience? Do you know anyone across racial lines that you can't resist calling beautiful? Do you know any person of another race not beautiful whom you think to be a tremendous person? Do you have any friends whose color you can't remember? Are you ever a guest across race lines, and do you have such guests? And is there someone of other races that you go to see just because you want to see them? Are you capable of being grateful across race lines without being secretly patronizing? Are there persons of other groups who are no longer a threat to you? Lord, I met a big man last summer. We were both on the platform at a college commencement up in Michigan. Pretty good school. Forgotten the name of it. But I remember his name. He is an expert in Southern history. One of the great blacks of our time, Dr. Hope Franklin, who is chairman of the Department of History at the University of Chicago. And I had the melting experience of realizing that here was a new man of a different race who could teach me, who was better at his work than I am at mine, and in whose manhood and integrity I could rejoice and admire. Is there anyone across these hateful barriers you have met and loved like a full brother, and you are therefore eligible for every high human relation? Have you learned to forswear the burdens of our adjectized existence? What I mean by that's this. Have you learned how much easier and grander it is to be just man than to have to be a white man or a Baptist man or anything else except a Christ man? Until our answers are all yes to questions like these, we're hardly in church at all, for the living of an ethic of redemption begins near here. No magic potion at the Lord's high table can bring a spring to us. There is a being and a doing without which our never-ending winter will stay where it lies, but somewhere near this ethic of act and being lies what hope we can muster.
So, you ask me, what is poverty? Listen to me. Here I am, dirty, smelly, and with no proper underwear on, and with the stench of my rotting teeth near you. I will tell you. Listen to me. Listen without pity. I cannot use your pity. Listen with understanding. Put yourself in my dirty, worn-out, ill-fitting shoes and listen. Hear me. Poverty is getting up every morning from a dirt and illness-stained mattress. The sheets have long since been used for diapers. Poverty is living in a smell that never leaves. This is a smell of urine, sour milk, and spoiling food, sometimes joined with the strong smell of long-cooked onions. Onions are cheap. If you have smelled this smell, you did not know how it came. It is the smell of the outdoor privy. It is the smell of young children who cannot walk the long, dark way in the night. It is the smell of the mattresses where years of accidents have happened. It is the smell of milk which has gone sour. Poverty is dirt. In your clean clothes coming from your clean house, you can say anybody can be clean. Let me explain about housekeeping without any money. For breakfast, I give my children grits with no Oreo or cornbread without eggs or Oreo. This does not use up many dishes. What dishes there are, I wash in cold water with no soap. Even the cheapest soap has to be saved for the baby's diapers. But you ask, why not hot water? Fuel costs money. If you have a wood fire, it costs money. If you burn electricity, it costs money. Hot water is a luxury. I do not have luxuries. I know you will be surprised when I tell you how young I am. I look so much older. My back has been bent over the washtubs every day for so long that I cannot remember when I ever did anything else. Every night I wash every stitch my school-aged child has on and just hope her clothes will be dry by morning. Poverty is staying up all night on cold nights to watch the fire, knowing that one spark on the newspaper covering the wall means that your sleeping children die in flames. In summer, poverty is watching gnats and flies devour your baby's tears when he cries. The screens are torn, and you pay so little rent that you know they may never be fixed. Poverty is an acid that drips on pride until all pride is worn away. Poverty is a chisel that chips on honor until honor is worn away. Some of you say that you would do something in my situation, and maybe you would for the first week or the first month, but for year after year after year. Even the poor can dream, a dream of a time when there is money. Money for the right kinds of food, for worm medicine, for iron pills, for toothbrushes, for hand cream, for a hammer and nails and a bit of screening, for a shovel, for a bit of paint, for some sheeting, for some needles and thread, money for a trip to town, and oh, money for hot water and for some soap. A dream of when asking for help does not eat away the last bit of pride. I have come out of my despair to tell you this. Remember, I did not come from another time or another place. Others like me are all around you. Look at us with angry hearts, anger that will help you help me, anger that will let you tell of me. The poor are always silent. Can you be silent too?